Hello? Hello? Testing, 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 1, 2, 3. Testing. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3.
Testing, testing.
Thank you all for coming this morning. We have Dr. Melissa Judina here to talk to us about grass, trees, and random walk. Let's give her a hand. Talk
Jackson is kind of more connected than Austin. If you looked at how many edges are coming out of Houston, you would see more of them. Now, the number of edges that come out of a certain point, we call the degree of that particular vertex. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The higher the degree of, you know, the more spokes there are coming out of that cup. We can talk also about how maybe some of your graphs are not entirely optimal, in the sense that you can move from one point to the other in two different ways. So you can focus on this one and that one. You can go around about like so, or the other way around like so. Okay, that means that we have created what's called a cycle. There's a path that goes in a cycle through a bunch of other vertices and comes back to the same one. Now, what if your graph is such that you have two disjoint parts? Disjoint means that they're separate. There's no connection between them. Then it's not a connected graph. It's disconnected. It's all very commonsensical. Now, why would you be interested even in that? Just imagine that this is some kind of a network where you really want connections to happen. So imagine you've got servers and optical cables. And then you can ask yourself, okay, so how many of my optical cables can be damaged so that I can still transfer my files from point A to point B? We will not answer these questions. These are complicated questions. We will just play games because it's kind of close to Thanksgiving and it's a Saturday morning. So let's start with a game. What we want to do is we want to see what happens on this map. You should have a pink paper in front of you that looks kind of like this. And you should probably have two buttons of different colors. And these two buttons are for one player each. What you have is a game of cat and mouse. And it was originally posed with this type of a map so that Sherlock Holmes is actually following somebody, a criminal, all over you. Now, what you have is that the cat, Mr. Holmes, starts his clock call. And what you have is that the criminal, that's the mouse, starts in pairs. So you can choose who's going to be the cat and who's going to be the mouse, and then you can start this. This is what you've got. Is everybody ready? So the rules of the game are then that the cat plays first. And every time that the move is made, the cat or the mouse can move just along one edge to its neighbor. So cannot have a two-legged left. Just one clock is allowed. And then once the cat makes its move, so for instance, you want to go, then the mouse, what does the mouse do? Run away. And the mouse is also very polite. He moves in one step at a time. And then it's the cat. And then it's the mouse. And now you can see that depending on how well the players are playing, you're going to have a different length of the game. So what's going to happen is that eventually you might get bored with it. But after 15 turns, after 15 steps, let's say, we're going to assume that the cat won if it didn't catch the mouse. What does it mean to catch the mouse? That means that you have them apart by one edge, and if the cat turns, and then the cat hops and eats the mouse. So why don't you try to play a game one, three, with your neighbor? That would be a nice warm-up for us today, just to have fun. And let's see who wins. Try to keep track of how many turns you take and who wins.
So do we start at where you have the current position?
That is the initial position. So the cat is in the Stockholm and the mouse is in Paris.
Okay.
And the cat plays first. And then you pick the Now, if you learn anything, please share it with the rest of us because we want to see if you have any kind of a strategy to know who's going to win.
Cats, not sure. But no, the cat. So let's see. Your claim is, I think, predominantly seems to be that the opinion is that the mouse is going to win just by exhausting the cat. Uh-huh. Basically, skittering around with the cat following it politely. But there is something that the cat can do to actually capture the mouse if the cat behaves cleverly. Yes?
You can sort of trap the mouse like in a corner somewhere, like in a triangle, to where when it's his turn, when no matter what it is, like it's really that way.
That's right. That is your goal, exactly. You cannot do it, however, in a triangle, really. What you have to have is a quadrilateral. So what you're trying to do is actually this kind of a position. Yes. What did you get?
So I see four ways that the cat will capture the mouse. One.
Do you want to show us over there? Can you reach up? You can reach up. Okay, we have a volunteer who can actually capture the mouse.
So one way is actually in the triangle.
Uh-huh.
You have the mouse up here and the cat over here.
Okay. Perfect. Yes.
Another way is the mouse is down here on this bone. The cat is in Paris.
Uh-huh.
And then another way is the cat is in Zurich. The mouse is in Rome.
Uh-huh.
And then the final way would be the cat's in Warsaw, and then the mouse is in Moscow.
Wow, you can also do Warsaw and Budapest, right? You can do that.
Right, because it's also for me.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So he gets the nail on the head. That is what's going to happen. What you need is a quadrilateral, and then what you want is for the cat and mouse to be in opposing quarters, right? And then whatever the mouse does, you can try and run all he wants, but the cat is going to pop on him and no more. Right? But we have to figure out how to get there. Thank you. So yes, you can get it in the quadrilateral if you did show us how to do it. So what I'm going to tell you is that we kind of have to move on, but I'm going to give you a hint. Try to play like this at home. You start with the cat in Stockholm, as you always do. And the mouse in Paris. That's what you do. But then try to persuade the cat to move towards Reykjavik as soon as possible. So let's see. Okay, cat wants to go to Oslo so he can fly to Iceland. And then the mouse goes anyway he wants, maybe to Zurich so that he can run away as far as possible. Then the cat goes to Reykjavik. Mouse flies to Venice. But then from Reykjavik, your cat wants to move as fast as possible towards the mouse. And then the mouse is running, trying not to get cornered, but the cat is closing in. So try to play with like that at home. If you want to, you can keep the paper. I don't think we even need the buttons anymore, so you can keep them, or you can give them back if you think you're going to lose them. That's what you're going to do. Now, let's see. This is not those nice games like this. Are we ready to move on? Do we want to do something new? Yeah. Okay, let's do something new. So, what did we say? Mathematically speaking, every single graph that you look at is going to be a pair of two things. One of the things is the set of vertices, and the other one is the set of edges. So let's see, you have B, and that is your set of all the vertices you have. And they represent whatever you want them to represent. I'm missing a C. And E is going to be your set of edges. Meaning connections of vertices. Sometimes you want your edges to point a certain direction. So for instance, if you had a very simple thing like that, a triangle, then that means, oh, these guys are friends. But sometimes, like, I don't know, a Jane Austen book or something, you can have this asymmetric love going on. So somebody loves somebody else, but they don't love them back, so then you have directed edges. Sometimes edges are done so that they move
there's an edge connecting B1 and B2, then we say that these two are adjacent. You can move one to the other. When you look at the number of edges that are coming out of a certain vertex, that number is called the degree of the edge. The degree of an edge, of a vertex, I'm sorry, is the number of edges coming out of it. Or into it, because we don't care about directions. Now I'm ready to give you a test, which may or may not be daunting, I don't know. Let us try to do the following. Let's try to construct a certain graph. That's our task. To construct a graph. And what you're given is the following. It has eight vertices altogether. So that's easy for now. But now, some difficult part. Four of the vertices have degree 4. And four of the vertices have degree 3. So if you have something to write with or a piece of paper, then you can do it on that. If not, just flip the map on its back and try to draw something like that. And try to communicate with the other. And we'll meet again in 5 minutes to see who got what. Are there any questions about the drawing? Do you need some clarification? Are you ready?
Yes.
Oh, I can say the many. Thank you.
almost like my sketch.
Or the eraser.
The whole thing. That's the arranger type. Because I wanted to put them in a plane so they don't intersect so much.
Right.
Do we need more time? Or are we okay with figuring it out? One more minute, okay. More minutes.
So we have to get syrup, so we're nice. So we have more people who actually figured it out. It's really awesome. I like that. So we have 1, 2, 3 people who did it. It's very awesome. I like that. It never occurred to me. Yes.
That is what you get when you take a four-sided pyramid and then put it out. You imagine that it's going to make a broken. It is connected, trust me. That is. Take all of the vertices, call them B, and then look at that. Okay, like so, I'm done. Now I have my vertices. This is my first one, my second one, my third one, my fourth one, my fifth one. And what I mean by doing this on the left-hand side is to take the first one, find its degree. It is 1, okay. Find the second one. What's its degree?
1.
Find the third one. What's its degree?
4.
Oh, that was quick, okay. Find the last one. The next to last one. Its degree is, I can see it, 2, and the V5 is the degree 5. So this is my short way of writing all of these. And I can do it for any graph. Now let's see, what did I get? 1, 2, 2, that means 10. Now let's count the edges. That's my first edge, second edge, third edge, fourth edge, fifth edge. So it is 2 times 5. And it will work out for every single one. Just does. Now let's see. What if you have a number of people, and then you're looking at a number of people at a party, and then you're figuring out who of them are friends and who are not friends. This here tells you, now carefully listen to what I have to say, that the number of people with an odd number of friends is even. Number of people with an odd number of friends is even. Were you able to parse that? Made sense? Okay, so that means if you see the number of friends everybody has as the degree of that vertex, the person with the vertex, then what you can do is you can sum up the number of friendships. But assuming friendship is symmetrical, you're actually double counting the friendships. So that's why it's the number of edges. But you know that the sum of all of these friendships needs to be an even number. If you had an odd number of people with an odd number of friendships, what would happen? The sum of them would be odd. So that's why this is called sometimes a handshake lemma, even though it's a bit more general, because it is about handshakes. We presumably shake the hands of people who are our friends. That's a huge thing, right? I'm going to write that so we can parse it. So in any group of people, finite group of people, the number of people with an odd number of friends is, what's the last word?
Even,
not evil. Okay, let's try another question. I'm going to give you a statement, and then you tell me why it is true. I'm going to tell you the following. This is my claim. Every graph contains at least 2 vertices of equal degree. Have I worn you out already? I hope not.
on holes to put them into, then at least one of the holes must have two objects.
Yes. So that's it. So if you, for instance, have like 3-4 pigeonholes, and then you have any number of letters that is higher than the number of pigeonholes, and you have to put allocate them into the available pigeonholes, you have to have at least one in which you have at least two letters. So it works not only for n minus one, but it also works for any number of mailboxes that you have, which is smaller than the number of available letters, right? And how does that apply to the R problem? We have lost their attention. Does anybody else know? You two have already done stuff. Can somebody else tell us? Not be shy. Okay, let's try. Go ahead. Why? Does that apply? Okay. Back to you.
Total degree of the sum of the degrees will always be more than the number of races, unless it's the graph is just one line and two lines.
So what we have is, okay, what's the maximum number of, what's the maximum degree? What are the possible values for degrees?
Zero
to n minus one. And then what can happen? Needs a little bit of thinking, right? Because you have 0 to n minus 1, and then you have n possible vertices, right? So if you have 0 to n minus 1, then that is n possible degrees, but there's also n vertices. So what's the reason? Can we have that happen?
No.
What?
Because the one that has n1 is 1 has to be connected to all the things, you cannot have any zero.
Perfect. Yes. So that means that you cannot have simultaneously 0 and n minus 1 in the arrangement. So one thing to do is take what, 1 to n minus 1 and?
So isn't it because like you have infinitely many points on the graph, so because of the pigeonhole principle, more than one, you have to have more than one point in position, which makes a vertex because you have two lines going on.
Well, we have only n points. We have finitely many points in the graph.
Okay, so
we're going to allow them.
Right, so n points
while they kind of regroup, or what do you think?
That sounds good. Kind of break, and we'll take 6 volunteers.
Okay, so the 6 volunteers should come over. Okay, let's come how long is the break?
Let's take a 10-minute break.
They don't know each other. And everybody either is friends or they don't know each other. So everybody has to be tied somehow. So let's try to do it. Okay, so I have a friend. You're going to be my first friend. You can, clever. Who wants to be a friend? Okay. All right, now let's give you another. Okay, Dad. Who wants to be a friend?
Oh, that's friend.
Or an enemy? now you two, what make you two enemies? That and what? That? Come closer so you can hold on to it. Yeah. And then, let's see. I'm making them do these things. You guys, you can be friends or unfriends. Going to have six of you, how many connections do we need?
Six.
That's a lot of connections, right? Do you think we can do it just in any way? Or is something going to happen? You're kind of like the problem here. Now let me see. Ooh! It hasn't happened yet. I'm trying to make something happen. It hasn't happened yet. Another people. Who hasn't been connected in any way yet? You haven't been connected to anybody. Let's do that. This is fun. With a hexagon like so.
is everybody on board with me right now? This is the hardest faith that we have so far.
Yes. I'm just a little confused about the non-friends, because I'm thinking, is that a connection of some kind or not?
It is a connection of some kind. So you can do it in two different ways. You can say, if people are not connected, then they're non-friends. But to be able to keep track of friends versus non-friends, it makes more sense to color code them. So what you could do is you could take a look at these six and say, I'm going to tie friends with a line and just do the green one. But then what you do is you say, okay, I also want to keep track of the non-friends, but in a better way than just keeping it blind. So that's why for the other category of edges, for the other kind of edge, you introduce a different color. And everybody's going to be connected in some way. Everybody needs to be connected to everybody else. That's correct. So that means that they cannot be undecided. They cannot abstain from being friends or not friends with somebody. It's one or the other. That makes sense? So is everybody on board right now? Because we need to think together to make this happen. I don't have a solution written up. I just have done it some number of times in my life.
Oh, there they are.
You know.
Non-friends.
Okay, so what I was saying is, let's focus on one protagonist, on one agent. And then we're going to look at everything from his perspective. All good so far? Okay, so let's see. This guy. The upper left, I'm going to fight. You can even give him a name if you want. So, every single one of the other people in the party is either his friend or his girlfriend. So, what can you tell me about that? If either friends or non-friends are all of these five remaining dots. Sorry?
They're all connected to him.
Well, they are all connected to him. It's just a matter of which are connected with pink and which are connected with green. So there's altogether five connections to be made, and you have two available colors. Yes?
Well, like, we have to define equals 32 different cases of different ways we could, like, do all of the five.
That's true, but you don't really, that gives us a total number of colorings. But some of those colorings are really kind of the same, right, if you shuffle them.
Right, because my arrangement of the colors,
that's right. But so we don't care really about the actual arrangement of colors. We care about the number of people who are friends and the number of people who are non-friends in 1 to 5. What can you compute about that?
That triangle.
Please.
Oh. Yeah, we have either all 5 could be three. Either all 5 could be friends, or 3 could be friends, or 2 could be friends.
Yes. Or 2 of them could be friends, or 1 could be friends.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But what you have. Yeah, the number of friends is different from the number of non-friends. That's also true. And they add up to 5. So if you have either friends or non-friends and you're trying to bunch them into categories, how many are going to end up in each of one of these categories? So let's see. Is it possible to have at most 2 friends and at most 2 non-friends? No, because that's 4. Okay, so that means that by the pigeonhole principle, you need to have at least 3 friends or at least 3 non-friends. Right? Okay, so which ones are going to be friends or non-friends that you're going to give me? Non-friends? That is not what I expected. So at least 3, we said. So let's say I'm going to reshuffle them, as you agreed we could do. I'm going to put his friends all to the left of the paper. So non-friends, non-friends, non-friends. So let's see. draw immediately.
Or you can draw the one from when you can draw from the highest from the right, from the left first one to the bottom left one, right, that one.
Yeah, that's what I'm using the same reasoning for. Is there anything else I can draw?
You have to draw the other one.
The other ones? Okay.
So
what now?
You've done
it.
One way or the other,
you're
done.
Oh, I have three friends in a triangle. And that's all. That's all you have to do. Yes?
That line that you're telling me, telling that eight, you get three enemies.
That's right. So I either get three friends or I get three enemies, but I get to have three of a kind. Isn't that so cool? And you need six of these. So this whole thing, which is obviously a generalization of the pigeonhole principle, right? We did it right now. We just used pigeonhole principle to get that. Tell me. Yes. Oh, so that's the whole key. Would it work with more than 6 points? Okay. It would work with more than 6 points. It wouldn't work with fewer than 6 points. So you would have the ability to do that. Because, you know, the more the points you have, the more people are going to be connected to their friends. Yes?
That was exactly my question. Why aren't we able to do this with, say, 5 points?
Ah, that's something that we are going to do in a little bit. So that's something you have to do. Draw a graph in which this doesn't happen. You have to be 5 people, right? But one point I wanted to make. Yes, this is just the beginning. So what you have is always you start with a complete graph, you say. What does that mean? Well, you start with a number of vertices. Let's say n. So you put your vertices like that, and I'm just going to put 4 because more than that gets incredibly messy. And then you tie every vertex to every other one. Have you heard of Mathematica software? So if you've heard of Mathematica software, then it has this function. It tells you, you can just ask it to draw your complete graph. And then you can actually ask it to draw your complete graph very nicely so that you get these lace-like structures that are just so beautiful to look at if you've got a hundred vertices or something like that. So this is the simplest one. Usually when you have a complete graph, you don't call it CN, you call it KN, I guess if we have Germans to thank for that. So K for complete and then N for the number of vertices. And then what you're thinking about is, okay, so each one of these vertices can be of quality 1 or quality 2, meaning it is either friends or enemies or, let's say, non-friends. And then the question is always, so if you have to build the smallest complete graph for which you can certainly say that you have at least a number of friends, say 3, or a number of friends, say enemies, say 3, then you're looking for the smallest graph that you can do so that you can surely say that. And that is called the Ramsey number. So the Ramsey number for 3, as we have already shown today, is 6. So we are looking at a complete graph. In this case, you start with a hexagon, and then you draw everything that there is to draw in it. And then you know that if you were to categorize these connections into two different groups, friends and enemies, say, then you would actually get a triangle of friends or a triangle of enemies. You can ask for other numbers. Say, can I get for sure a triangle of friends and a quadrangle of enemies? Everybody's connected in there, and they're all enemies. Or everybody's connected in the triangle, they're all enemies. Or you can say, well, can I find soul. So what you do have is that we know now, we have known it for, well, let's say 20 years, we know the R44. R44 was, after some work, proved to be 18. Now, R45, what does this mean? The smallest complete graph I can make so that I can guarantee a group of four friends or a group of five enemies, that turns out to be 25. What do you think R55 is? Just a guess, what do you think? Yeah. So, 25. We have one guess. Other people, what do you think? This is our guess. Yes.
42.
Wonderful. You guys, the time?
28.
60. 60, that's also good. I don't know how you got the 42. Is it the Hitchhiker's Guide or something like that that prompted you to say that? But we don't know. We don't know. There are bounds, and we don't know. The 44 Ramsey number, I bet with some work you could just sit down and, you know, think about it and understand eventually the proof. But the 55, we don't know. And what we do know are bounds. So the bounds that we have are 43 and 49. So we know that it is at least 43 and at most 49. And some clever people have asked the computer to just go ahead and count through the arrangements, and they think it's 43, but they don't know. So your 42 is almost there, but it's not quite there. And now I have a fun quote, which is attributed to Jacques. I'm going to show you it, and it's so good. It says this. Who here knows who Paul Erdős was? Yes, please.
Okay.
Yes, please, you haven't said anything.
The number theory mathematician.
Yes, he was most well known for number theory, but he did all kinds of math. And I think that the reason he did number theory was because it was his preferred field, but he could have done whatever he wanted. Paul Erdős was a Hungarian mathematician who died actually quite recently. What, 10 years ago or something? Oh, that's recent for me. You weren't even born yet. But okay, he was well known for not only being in love with math, but also for really wanting to popularize things. So I actually met people who met Paul Erdős at a camp, just like this one in Hungary. So he would come, even though he was world renowned, and just talk to the little kids and, you know, show them games and puzzles. And everybody really liked this guy. Now, this guy also made statements about math, and one of the statements is this one. So, he said, apparently, if this is attributed to him, Erdős asks us to imagine an alien force vastly more powerful than us, landing on Earth and demanding the value of R55, or they will destroy our planet. Well, there's your Hitchhiker's Guide universe, to the galaxy. So, if that happens, he claims, we should marshal all our computers and all our mathematicians and attempt to find the balance. So this is something within the human grasp, apparently. However, suppose instead that they ask for R66. In that case, he believes we should attempt to destroy the aliens, because it's easier to destroy the aliens than to find the next Ramsey number, if you can believe that. So this is really, really nice. If you're on the mailing list, I can give you a couple of links to nice YouTube videos about transient theory. And what we did here, they did with, you know, they were much nicer than I was. They did it with animated people that were friends and enemies and not dying children to each other. So now that we're talking about Erdős, do you know what Erdős number is? It has to do both with Erdős, obviously, and with graph theory. This is awesome. So what by him or herself. People like to have collaborators because it's just much more fun to work with other people and have more ideas. Erdős was one of the most prolific collaborators ever. He would just fly around. He never had a house of his own. He actually would stay at people's houses, people's apartments. One of our former department chairs here was a collaborator of Erdős's. And Erdős would stay in his house while in Austin and, you know, hand wash his undergarments, basically. So that's just it. He wrote a paper with him, obviously, and also with other people. Now, mind you, this wasn't a paper in number theory. This was a rings of functions or something like that. So what do you have? You have this prestige in the mathematical community, which comes from how close you are, in a certain sense, to Paul Erdős. So if you write a paper with somebody, then you're tied with a connection. Every mathematician is a vertex. Every time the two write a graph, write a paper together, they are connected. There's an edge in the graph between them. And because Erdős was so prolific and friendly, he has a bunch of people who are connected to him. So you have your Erdős, and then you have his collaborators. And as I said, it's a matter of prestige. So mathematicians have decided to assign a number to every single one of these guys. And they have the Erdős number one, because they could collaborate directly with Erdős. Now, what they did, they didn't work by themselves throughout their careers, so maybe they had different collaborators. Look, it's a social network. It's like Facebook, just for mathematicians. And maybe they had joint collaborators. But everybody who was a collaborator or a collaborator gets the number two. Now, these guys may have collaborators. And they get the number, the average number, three. Because there are three edges removed from average. Now, if a person collaborated here with this guy, but also here with this guy, what is his or her Erdős number going to be?
Two.
Two, because this is the fewest number of steps that we can go there. My Erdős number, the best that I can get is actually five, which is not much. But I have written a paper with my advisor, who wrote a paper with another advisor, who wrote a paper with a guy from Zurich, who wrote a paper with somebody, who wrote a paper with Erdős. I think that's a good change. So this is almost as prestigious in mathematics as looking at math genealogy. Have you heard about the math genealogy project? Well, it has something to do with the next thing I want to talk about. So let's see. Graphs are not only nice because we can study them, but also because we can display some other findings. So there is the notion of a tree. And a tree is a type of a graph which doesn't have those spikes. So when you have a tree, it literally has this kind of a shape. So it others. And to do it correctly, you connect them with you. Some people in optimization like to look at algorithms, which allow them to see what they can destroy and what they can keep as they move through the tree. But we won't do that now. What I want us to know is what the trees are. So what you can get is, look at this. You can start with a grid. So you start with your this. This is just a grid, just a quadratic grid. Nothing special about it. But what you can look for is a spanning tree for it, meaning keep some edges, discard the others, while keeping stuff, while keeping them connected. What does this mean? This means that basically you start with a block of stone, and then you kill some of the stone. But you still keep the paths, you keep the stone connected, it's still one single block. And you can think about, well, how can water go through this stone? Or you can think about, well, is it going to go every single place, or is it going to just flow through one? Is it connected this way or that way? Or you can just go ahead and do it as a maze. So the one who left, who is six, he likes to have these random mazes so he can solve them. Some you can solve, some you cannot solve that nicely, but you know, you can play with them if you want to. There is a game which is based on this. That game is called You Wouldn't Believe How Imaginative. The people who invented the game were, it's called Color the Grid. So you start with a grid, and then you color it. So you can get sheets of paper like this, and then you can spend time on an airplane again, having fun. You have two different colors, and the goal is to have players who are going to take turns in coloring one edge. So the boundary is also allowed at a time. You do this, you do that. And the first guy does that, but see what happens? They are not allowed to make this one because you won't allow, disallow cycles. So you have to work hard not to do cycles. It's a variation of what some people are calling, I don't know, it usually involves some kind of cattle that you're trying to occupy and then to win a certain number of these cells. So you can do that, and then you can continue to do it until there are no moves left. And then whoever has the next turn and cannot make a move, well, they lose. That's the game. I wanted us to play the game, but we don't have the time. I want us to do something which has something to do with what you had maybe a month ago. Branching processes, what was that?
About a month ago, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So maybe a month ago we talked about here about something called branching processes. And this was about generations of a family. So for those of you who maybe missed it or cannot remember because you had so much schoolwork to do, what the idea was is the following. You have one entity. It's good to think of them as not people, but say bacteria or something like that. So you have one entity, and that entity can have offspring. So you start with this progenitor, right? And then, of course, nobody has, in most of our models, they do not have a fixed number of children. So it's not like everybody is for sure going to have offspring, and if they are even going to have offspring, it's not for sure how many they're going to have. Now we kind of count on people being more likely to have one than 17 children. So that means that you have a certain distribution on the number of kids they're going to have. So that's what we call a distribution, kind of the relative likelihood of different outcomes, in this case the number of offspring. So then what you do is you basically roll the proverbial die and then figure out how many offspring this guy's going to have. Now, I don't want them to have more than three kids, because I do not want to draw a lot. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that if the number is divisible by 3, 0. If it leaves a remainder of 1 when divided by 3, 1 child. If it leaves the remainder to that reality and onto the next phase of the experiment. And then you can also move into the other reality and into the phase of the experiment. And that becomes a tree. That can be a decision tree. It can get very morbid, actually. You can have these actuaries making models for who is going to pay them the benefit premium and who will not. That's for parents, the other situation. Okay, but we have introduced randomness, so I have one more thing that I would like to share now. And then if we have time, we can play the color of gray. Is that okay with you? Okay. So what I want to share next is going to be the notion of a random walk. So when you talk about the random walk, usually you start with a randomization device. You're going to start very, very deeply. You're going to start at some point. Let's say this is a grasshopper. And the grasshopper can jump one step to the left or one step to the right. Now, this grasshopper has problems with guiding stuff. So he's going to roll it out on top of point. Let's say if he rolls an even number, he hops to the left. If he rolls an odd number, hop to the right. I would love to do it. And what you can do is you can go ahead and keep track of where the grasshopper is. So let's say left, well, maybe another left, and then the right, and then the right, and then the left, okay, the left, right. Okay, so this is already messy. I don't like that. So if you have ever seen an EKG, that's the thing where they keep track of how your heart beats. So, you know, if you just let the strip stay in one spot, it would just be a mess. So instead of letting a grasshopper just go right and left and right, what you can do is we can go ahead and say, okay, every time the grasshopper makes a leap, we're going to pull a bit of that strip towards us so that we can keep track of his position in time, so that we don't draw on the same line over and over and over again. So what we are going to do is we're going to start at zero, and then if he jumps, say, to the left, that means, okay, maybe his position decreased by one, and you move the strip a little bit, then he makes another step, maybe to the right, and he's back at zero, and then your strip moved a little bit, and then that way, you can actually go ahead and draw his position as a function of time. So that's what you do. So let's see. You start here at zero, and then you're moving with time to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What they're doing here is time. And he starts at the level zero, and then let's say goes up with the even. This is an even number, he hops up. That means that at time one, his position is here. Down for the odd number. Up for the even number. Down for the odd number. This is surprisingly irregular. Down for the odd number. I could look it up and throw it up. And down for the odd number. See what happened. Now, if you just have these red dots, it's not very good exposition of what's going on. So what you do is you don't do that. You actually draw lines to connect them. Right? And then if you look at this graph, you can also look at both the other possible graphs at the same time. So your grasshopper isn't necessarily going to go up, down, up, down. It could have gone up. Up, down, up, maybe then down, and then another down, and maybe another down, like so. Now, each time that you look at what your grasshopper can do, you have another path, his trajectory, but this trajectory is also a type of a tree. So what you really have is kind of this whole of possible paths that you can take from moving up, 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 up until he's gone to level 6 and down 6 and down, 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 down into the other extreme, to negative. So what you want to do is maybe see what would happen if they pop on a grid. So you can have a random walk, which is not a random walk on a line like that, but it's a random walk in space. You just don't allow them to pop every which way they want. You want them to kind of keep on a certain grid. So let's see if this is visible. I tried to make it. Yes, it's visible. So maybe it would be better to be a honeybee, seeing that this is a hexagonal grid. Hexagonal grids are nice because they provide a tessellation of the space, and also because if you don't allow your bee to actually go back, every time that she is at the node, she can go left or right. So you can again say, okay, I'm going to move left with probability 1/2 and right with probability 1/2. Now let's see. The bee starts somewhere in the middle of the hive, let's say here. And then you can play games. You can say, okay, so let's see. My bee first went this way. And then I can roll a die and just decide that, let's roll. My bee, it is even. Oh, no, this is odd, right? So it went right. And then odd, it went right again from the perspective of this. And then odd, again it went right. Odd, it went right. Even, it went left from its perspective. And then you can do these crazy steps. And then you can ask yourself, okay, so if I do this, how long will it take me on average to actually get to the rim? Or will I be able to ever get back to where I started? How long will it take me to get back to where I started from? Now, this how long, that is random, kind of, depending on how I'm moving. So I can look at all the possible paths, look at how probable they are, maybe calculate something that would call the expected time until I get back. Am I going to spend a long time getting back? We don't. Well, mathematicians do know, but that's something for you to think about, really. And I'm not going to tell you what's happening. We have answers for grids that are just regular grids, Euclidean, squares. We have grids for all kinds of other shapes as well. Now, the other thing that I wanted to tell you, and that's the last thing I want to tell you, is that if you look at even the easier example, your grasshopper, or your example with your little bike going on the grid. You can imagine that they're actually not constrained to the grid, but they're actually moving in space. And then what happens is that they don't really wait like a minute or a dive to move. What happens is that they move basically continuously. If you look at very small particles, they're just going to go ahead and bump back. And they're going to do that in a random fashion. Well, to us it seems random. If you had perfect clarity about the physical laws and the conditions in which they are, you could probably figure it out. And of course, into the computational power. But, we're constrained by our abilities and the knowledge we have, so we are going to go ahead and just say, okay, it's random. I know it's more likely to be this and less likely to be that, but I don't know what it is. So I'm going to assign a distribution. So what your particle does, say, hint, a little piece of pollen in a petri dish, is it moves about. And it moves about in what we think is a random fashion. But the reason that it moves about is that there are all these invisible particles which bump into it. So they're going to be the ones that are your roll of a dot, that is going to tell it, okay, I'm bumping you to the left, or I'm bumping you to the right. They are going to be the ones to give them a push. But you don't see the environment, you just see what's glowing, you see the dust, the pollen dust. And that's how Mr. Brown discovered what we now call Brownian motion. But the grasshopper is in one dimension, and Mr. Brown was talking about the petri dish. What you may like that, then this is a group error. You cannot move it. So you can play this on the one. Yes.
So what were the rules?
You start with the three crosses.
Yeah.
And what you're allowed to do is you have to just continue the cross. So you can loop around, and then you have to connect to another one of the lines in the cross. But it cannot, it doesn't have to be the same one. It can't be the same one, so that you loop in. And you're not allowed to cross an already existing line, and you cannot double move the X part.
And the next person must choose a different line. A different line, but also a different cross.
Well, they have to choose among the ones that are available still. So this green guy wouldn't need to do what I just did. I'm just demonstrating that they're not allowed to intersect. So that's fine. Okay.
Is this also a futile game like this type of?
Yeah, it is. And there is... This is similar to this. So you may have heard of this. It's called crisscross. It's just that the crisscross doesn't have one single layout. So this has one single layout. Crisscross has. You start always with three dots that are somehow like this, as in a triangle, and then you can add on the inside a number of dots. It's best to start with two because having just one is silly. So what you have is that you are allowed to again take turns connecting the dots that are available to you, but you cannot intersect the already existing ones. So your green would do that, perhaps, then your pink would maybe do this, then your green would do, I don't know, see that, your pink would maybe do that. I'm not playing cleverly. Your green would do this, your pink would do that, your green would do this. Your pink would do that, your green would do this, and red, because the pink cannot do anything that doesn't intersect something already existing. So you don't necessarily have these, you can have a different arrangement. So you can start with three, so again in an equilateral triangle, but then for instance add a more complicated arrangement in there, so you have four. And what's fun about it is not necessarily playing, but figuring out who necessarily has to win, because there are strategies in these games. Okay, sorry, I went over.
Let's thank the speaker again. Thank you very much for coming. We will have one last event next Sunday at 1 p.m. And I think this is a great talk, and I think we have another talk to look forward to. I think the speaker is going to talk about vampires and zombies, and zompires, which are offsprings of the vampire and a zombie. So thank you very much for coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I recommend it.
Yeah. Very nice
and extremely tall. Oh. Yeah.
Vampire is Saturday at 1 o'clock. Right. Yeah, but you know, if you want, you have to leave, you can leave it.
Have
to. We will have the video up. So.
Where would it be?
Oh, website? Is it on the website?
No, but I'll
just. So if you go to ma.utexas.edu and just / Saturday morning wrapping, and then you
mention it. Oh, that's what it's on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And after the next Sunday, what's that for?
It will be next week.
Well, next year.
Right. Because things are kind of wrapping up, you know, everybody has finals. And
next year versus next semester?
Right.
Thank you for coming.